This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Professor Glenn White of the Open University and also the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory has been giving a colloquium at Jodl Bank today about observations at far infrared and submillimeter wavelengths, and particularly studies of our own galaxy. So, first of all, what is it that these wavelengths give us in astronomy that others can't?
One of the problems we have is that the galaxy is quite opaque when we try to observe its emission. In other words, we can't see very far around us, only a few thousand light years, because small particles in the space between the stars, the so-called interstellar dust, absorb the light and prevent us from seeing anything other than our closest galactic environment. The far infrared wavelengths that I work at have the advantage that they penetrate much further through the galaxy and allow us to observe material even when it's at the other edge of the galaxy. So we have a much greater volume of space to look through with our infrared eyes than we do with our optical eyes. And we've been very fortunate in Europe that over the last 30 years we've had many space missions which have very sensitive detectors at these wavelengths that have been able to make surveys of our galaxy and of our universe to search for all the phenomena that we can uniquely study, such as how stars are born, where planets might be orbiting other stars, how material around old stars after they've lived their lifetime and died is thrown back out into space and cycled back in again to the next generation of stars. So many of these phenomena we can only observe at far infrared wavelengths because of the ability of those wavelengths to penetrate so far around us and let us see our galactic neighbourhood.
So how is it that those particular phenomena that you're looking at come to be emitting in the far infrared and submillimeter?
Most of the emission at far infrared wavelengths is rather akin to heat radiation. So what we're actually seeing is the heat radiation of small solid particles, perhaps made of carbon or silicon, rather common elements on the Earth, which are heated by the light of stars. And that starlight is absorbed onto these small particles and is re-radiated at infrared wavelengths as effectively heat. So what we really have are sensitive thermometers in space, which instead of registering my temperature when I put a little glass bulb into my mouth, can actually remotely measure the temperature of a small dust grain, a millionth of a meter in diameter, that's at a distance of 10,000 light years away from me. And you just try and imagine how difficult it would be for me to measure the temperature of you as the listener just a few feet away from me. And here I am trying to measure something at the distance of tens of thousands of light years. It's a real mind blower.
It is. So that dust becomes an advantage then at these wavelengths. It's actually passing on the information about what it's surrounding.
Indeed, the infrared is so powerful in its ability to penetrate to large distances that it is one of the only ways that we're able to look back even to the beginnings of the universe, the so-called cosmic microwave background. And it's really by focusing on these long wavelengths and the particular kinds of emissions that we see, the so-called thermal emission, that in the case of the cosmic microwave background, the history of our universe, we're able to look back to things as they were tens of billions of years ago.
And what instruments are we using to do that currently?
The kinds of detectors that we use are made of semiconductors. They're the kind of material that we find in transistor radios or computers, but they're often cooled down to very, very low temperatures of perhaps a few tenths of a degree Kelvin above absolute zero. So a typical detector of this kind in a space satellite would be contained inside a large bath or a large container of liquid helium, which is cooled down to extremely low temperatures of a few degrees, maybe 4 degrees above absolute zero, and then by various other technologies is brought down to just a few tenths of a degree above absolute zero. And the reason we're trying to do that is that if you're trying to measure these incredibly low thermal signatures, the incredibly low temperatures of objects that are a very large distance away, you don't want the heat radiation of your detector to swamp this very feeble faint radiation that you're trying to detect. So by cooling our detectors down to very low temperatures, the very faint emissions that we're trying to detect in space are still capable of being detected. But of course this means that we have to fly lots of helium or coolants in space, and this is why our current space mission, the Herschel Space Telescope, is about the size of a London bus in orbit, because the great majority of its volume is taken up by flying a large tank of liquid helium.
So it's quite high tech. Is that something that you have to do from space?
The radiation we're trying to detect is very effectively absorbed in the Earth's atmosphere. So none of the radiation, this crucial radiation that's telling us about star formation or planets or the earliest stages of the universe, none of that radiation is able to get down to even our telescopes at the tops of high mountains. So the only way we can do this kind of work is to do it from space. And that's why we've had this 30-year history of developing big space instruments and flying them as observatories to try to detect these very important, very unique signals of the properties of material in the galaxy.
Okay. Well, we don't have a lot of time, but the thing I was most interested in during your talk was when you spoke about the interstellar medium, the dust and diffuse material in our own galaxy, having a characteristic filamentary structure, sort of pillars or threads that are where star formation often happens. Could you tell us what you've been able to discover about that?
We're interested in finding out how stars are born, how planets might be formed around them. And so we want to understand this process that allows these massive objects, stars that are burning hydrogen, providing the fuel and heat to sustain life, how they can come into existence. And what we believe happens is that clouds of material, the same material that will form the stars, clouds of hydrogen gas, collapse under their own weight, under their own gravity. But what we've been finding is that this is not a random process spontaneously happening wherever you look in the galaxy. It seems to preferentially form in regions that we call naturally star formation regions that often appear as filaments or kind of strings of pearls, where the small dense regions on those strings or filaments have just the right conditions to come together, collapse under their own weight, under gravity, and to form stars. And what our current observatory, the Herschel Space Observatory, has been showing us and revealing to us is that almost all of the material in the galaxy is structured or formed into these long interstellar filaments that are many, many light years in length and a fraction of a light year across. And we're starting to see that this is one of the fundamental structures that goes on eventually to form stars. And so by studying the ubiquity, the everywhereness of this filamentary structure, we've begun to learn about the early conditions that lead to the formation of stars and ultimately probably to life as we know it.
And something I'd really like to know is, are these filaments related to the mechanism of the very large-scale universe, where we see galaxies forming in filaments and galaxy clusters developing at the vertices of these filaments? Is it the same sort of physics?
Everywhere we look in the universe, we see structures on one sky scale or another that seem to be aligned in filaments, whether it's the chains of the so-called dark matter that joins together clusters of galaxies, or whether it's the arms of galaxies, the so-called spiral arms, or now the small structures, the filaments that we see in star formation regions. So I think we're starting to learn that these kinds of structures are everywhere, and that they are intimately connected not only to the formation of stars and planets, but also to the larger scale structures in the universe. We even sort of know the basic physics of how that happens. It comes through a process that's called turbulence. But it's a very complicated subject, and we're only just now starting to assemble the basic data sets together that are allowing us to observe this process in action. And over the year or two to come, we hope to take those data and those new results and turn them into a new understanding of the physical processes that control everything in the universe on both the small scale, the star formation and planet formation, right up to the large scale structure of the universe.
Well, that is really fascinating. I think we've run out of time, so I'll say thank you very much there.